Some of the 34 genesis then it's quick to get on and see what happens at Shechem, where Jacob now is. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which he bare to Jacob, was actually the daughter of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her, and she defiled her. And his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto the damsel. And Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, get me this damsel's wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. The sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had brought folly in Israel, and lying with Jacob's daughter. This thing ought not to be done. And Hamor communed with him, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you, give her him to wife. Make ye marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you. Ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get your possessions therein. And Shechem said unto her father and unto her brethren, let me find grace in your eyes. And what you shall say unto me, I will give. Ask me never so much dowry and gift. I will give according as you say to me, but give me the damsel for life. The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father deceitfully, and said, because he had defiled their sister. And they said unto them, we cannot do this thing, give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. But in this will we consent unto you, if you will be as we be, and every male of you be circumcised, then we will give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not hearken unto us to be circumcised, then will we take our daughter, and we will be gone. And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem Hamor's son. And the young man deferred not to do the thing, because he had delighted in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the house of his father. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of their city, and communed with the men of their city, saying, these men are peaceable with us, therefore let them dwell in the land, and trade therein. For the land, behold, is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us that dwell with us, be one people, if every male among us be circumcised, as they are circumcised. Shall not their cattle, and their substance, and every beast of theirs be ours? We let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. And unto Hamor, and to Shechem, his son hearkened all that went out of the gate of his city, and every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of his city. And it came to pass, on the third day, when they were sore, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword, and came upon the city boldly, and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem his son, who took the sword, and took Dinah out of Shechem's house, and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city, because they had defiled their sister. They took their sheep and their oxen, their asses, and that which is in the city, and that which is in the field, and all their wealth, and all their little ones, and their wives, took their captives, and spoiled even all that was in the house. And Jacob said to Simeon and to Levi, ye have troubled me to make me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites, among the Perizzites. And I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. And they said, should he deal with our sister? As with a harlot. And so the last word seems to rest with them. But in actual fact it doesn't, because the last word will rest with Jacob, in chapter 49 of this book when he passes the blessing onto the children, onto his sons. Well, now, Shechem appeared to be a very advantageous place to live in, or to live nearby. Seems to be, if you look at the map, in a good position. And there were the facilities of the city nearby. What could be better? You know, it is something like that sometimes when we select where we live. Delightful surroundings, good amenities, good school for the children. And yet, sadly, sometimes Christians never go on to inquire about the spiritual provisions of the place. What sort of local church does it have? Has other advantages? But sometimes they fail to recognize or to question about the real very thing they should be asking. What sort of spiritual provision does this place have? And the supreme choice of a new home should be, what would it do for my spiritual life? I'm telling you this today, and I'm in the process, or probably in the process of moving. And it is one of the things which concerns me. We will be moving to a place, and we will be looking for an assembly in that place. And it's one of the considerations that I have now to face. But I trust that the primary consideration will be the sort of place where I will be able to go, assembly I'll be able to go to, fellowship with, and worship at. And that will be the first consideration Jill and myself are taking into account. There are other considerations, but that will be the primary one. Now, Jacob, who chose to live near Shechem, with all its risks involved, and the results are soon to be seen. And they are seen in the first verses of this chapter. Like Lot before him, there doesn't seem to be any testimony by Jacob in Shechem. And that might be so, because there was no real difference at the time between them and him. They didn't care for his altar, so long as he lived with them, did as they did. And what good was his altar do in the face of his wife, day by day, as one of themselves, if they didn't see any difference between them and him. The problem is, of course, that with a Christian, that wilderness lowers the tone of the testimony. And if the banner isn't displayed because the life isn't true, then no blessing is achieved. The Gospel of John, which we were looking at last year, has some very clear things to say about separation from the world. And wilderness can only be prevented by separation. And in John 17, the sevenfold attitude of the believer to the world is given. And this is what it says. Verse 6 will tell us, we are given to Christ out of the world. Verse 11 will tell us that we are in the world, but not of it. Verse 14 will tell us that we are hated by the world. Verse 14 will also tell us that we are not of the world. And verse 15 will tell us we are to be taken out, not to be taken out of the world, but we need to be kept from the evil. And verse 18 will tell us that we are sent into the world, we are sent to be his witnesses. And verse will also tell us that we are sent into the world, that the world might know who the Master is. And so the Bible gives us clear direction about separation from wilderness. And though we are in the world, clearly, we are to be distinct and different from it. The problem is not so much of us being in the world. The problem is that of when the world gets into the Christian. That's a big problem. Now, all these things, of course, can be realized by true spiritual separation from the world. And it may be difficult to define exactly where the line of separation occurs, but the fact and necessity of it are indisputable, however. Now, the notable lack of discipline in Jacob's family becomes noticeable here in the opening verses, and in the events that follow. And as you go through the chapter, you remember that it ended actually with reference to this altar, the god of Jacob, of Israel rather. But in this chapter, there's no mention of God. There's no mention at all of God in the chapter. And it's interesting when you read that, because it gives some idea of the reason for the events which follow. Now, the events may never have happened if Jacob had kept his position as a pilgrim and a stranger. The events would never have happened if, rather than build houses and living on the edge of the city, he had kept to his tent. The events may never have happened if, instead of going into this particular city, or even near it, he had gone straight on his way down to Bethel. These events would not have happened. And one of the things which you notice in this chapter as well is this, that through the chapter, Jacob remains silent until you come to the end of the chapter. And then he remonstrates with his brothers. But he doesn't remonstrate that their action has done damage to the name of God. That name which was mentioned when he built his altar. His problem is that their action has caused his name to stink amongst the neighbors. So he's not even concerned about the name of God in this. He is concerned about his own name in this. And so there's something of a decline in the relationship that Jacob has here. And he remains silent in the chapter. And when he does speak, of course, it's too late. Those who take the lead in the chapter are his sons, and in particular, Simeon and Levi. Though at the end, you will notice, it says, the sons of Jacob came in and took the spoil. So it was the two sons, first of all, who initiated the thing. But when it came to getting the spoil, the sons of Jacob, that is all of them, took part in that. And he seems to have lost control here over the conduct of his children. Now, the opening verses will tell us that the lights of the city were too much for Dinah. She'd been used to a much quieter lifestyle. She'd been used to a nomadic lifestyle. She was not a city girl. And she certainly wasn't prepared for the life of Shechem. And it might be something which is, we might have in our minds, question whether Jacob and Leah did warn their daughter of these dangers in Shechem, or whether they did not. See, the world can look very attractive to children who are brought up in the shelter of Christian home, particularly when they get away from the influence of the Christian home, and particularly if they've not been taught to fear the dangers of the world. And one might ask the question, why did Jacob allow such freedom in such a place as Shechem? Well, quite obviously from the story that you've read, the morals of the city, the people of the city, were pretty low. You know, it's perhaps strange and ironic that very often those who are brought up in a godless home know more truly how shallow and how shameful a place the world is than those who perhaps have been brought up in a shelter of a Christian home and are dazzled by its attractions when they come first into contact with it. Perhaps it was that Jacob hadn't taken care to find out who the companions were. The person's peers are very influential upon a person's life. And Dinah mixed with the girls of Shechem. And a person's peers, their opinions, very quickly, they become very opinion makers in the lives of others. And life and peer pressure is very strong in the days in which we live. We live in an age, and certainly I know these in Britain, that if you go to a child and person, go to a high school, that they will find that if they stick to their standards, they will be denigrated, despised, and criticized, and condemned, and ridiculed, because they have standards. Problem is that too often young people in the schools of Britain today have no standards. That's partly because their parents haven't. And peer pressure to do what they do is immensely strong on young people in schools in Britain. And sexuality, immorality, drink, drugs, all those things are brought their pressures to bear upon young children, young people in our school home. And I'm not aware of the situation in America, but I should imagine that there is something similar to that here. Except that in Britain, there will be less of a Christian background. And we need to pray for our young people in school, because peer pressure is one of the strongest pressures that you can have brought upon them. And quite clearly, the moral principles of Shechem were not those of Jacob and of Leah. And Dinah soon forgot the father's principles under the spell of Shechem. Of course, he was no match for the young prince. And what you read of him, he seems to be somebody who would have been attractive, and certainly somebody who she gave into quite easily. But after all, I suppose, when you think of Dinah here, were not her scruples old-fashioned? That's probably the argument which was put up against any reticence on her part or resistance on her part. After all, her peers were not constrained or confined by such thinking. And then, of course, we look at the other side of things, and we have to look and notice how the chapter describes the deed which happened. And you will notice how it describes it. Verse 5, defiled. Verse 13, and it says defiled. Verse 17, I've got the wrong verse there, but anyway, there we are, there are two verses there. Where is the word which is used is defiled. And you will notice the word defiled means desecrated. And it's used later in Psalm 79, that same word, and it's used to describe the defilement or desecration of the temple. What it is saying is the dishonor of womanhood seen here in the defilement of Dinah and the desecration of the Holy of Holies are regarded by the same feelings and are described by the same word. Defile. Desecrate. And in this way, the word of God regards personal purity and notes and denounces the sin which dishonors it here in this chapter. And the situation, of course, called the delicate handmaid. Shechem, that is the son, the prince, did try to do the honourable thing. And he wanted his father to negotiate a marriage with Dinah. And Jacob heard about the matter, but he did nothing. But his sons Levi and Simeon, when they heard about the matter, they came in from the field, and they took charge, and they began to plot the matter. They hear the full story, and their first reaction to it is pain or grief. The second reaction is anger against Shechem for his disgraceful conduct. And you'll notice how angry they become when they hear of the deed. Verse 7, the sons of Jacob came out of the field, and they heard it, and the men were grieved, pained. Then they were very wroth, because they brought folly in Israel, nine of Jacob's daughter, which they ought not to be done. You know, they were angry, they were grieved. It comes easy, doesn't it, for human nature to display indignation at the sins of others, when so far we have not been guilty of that particular fault ourselves. But if we stand and we don't fall into that fault, it is not a matter of self-congratulation. It's a call to caution in case we do fall into it. You must remember what the Apostle writes in the New Testament, when he writes in the last chapter to the Galatians, and he says, "But," and then he says, "if a man be overtaken in a fault," see, here's a man who might have been going straight, and then he was overtaken in a fault, he was suddenly taken unaware. But more the point is the word which he gives to the Corinthians, and it is against any self-congratulation in standing or going straight on our own strength, because he says, in writing to the Galatians, the 10th chapter, that him that thinketh he standeth, take heed lest he fall. And so it is here that those who condemned Shechem were in their own hearts nursing murderous and treacherous intentions. And two of them, not now, but later, Reuben and Judah, were to prove capable of very aggravated forms of Shechem's sin. You remember that what the later chapters will tell us, that is that Reuben committed incest with his father's concubine, and that Judah had sexual relations with someone who he thought was a harlot, but who proved to be his daughter-in-law. And so the people here who were condemning and angry at what Shechem had done, and it was wrong, very wrong, yet later themselves, sadly, which in that world could commit even sadder crimes. I notice the strength of the brothers then. The reason for their anger had been that their sister had been defiled. And they say in the chapter that such things as sexual intercourse before marriage ought not to be allowed. That's what they mean when they say in verse 31, should she deal with our daughter as with a harlot. The Bible is in no way relaxed in its extraordinary high standards, as far as the world is concerned, of premarital chastity amongst the people of God, and of faithfulness to the vows which are implied in the marriage bond. And one aspect of the life of Christians which should distinguish them from the world around us is their attitude and conduct in matter of sex and of marriage. And you will recall, of course, that later on in the story of David, I'm not thinking of David's sin now, which is wrong, but I'm thinking simply of a young man who wanted to have sexual relations with his sister. And her cry was, "Such a thing is not heard of in Israel." And so you will get the idea that these things, as far as God's law was concerned, were not permissible in Israel. But then, of course, when you come a bit further and you come to the Acts, and you read the first council in Acts chapter 15, you will remember the letter which was sent out. And what the letter stated, amongst other things, it stated first that Gentiles should abstain, it says, and this is what it was saying, from pollution of idols and from fornication. And when the apostle wrote to one of the Thessalonians, he says, "For this is the will of God in your sanctification, that you abstain from fornication." And we live in a world where the standards of the world sometimes permeate into the church. My son-in-law, some years ago, was working as an evangelist in universities. Started the university year, a freshman, with a gospel crusade. At the end of the meetings, they would have a counseling session for people who wanted to trust the Lord Jesus. And found that in the counseling session, there were more people who wanted to be counseled concerning their Christian life than unsaved who wanted to trust the Savior. And the primary thing was, of young Christians who had entered university but were engaging in sexual relationships before marriage, and they needed counseling constantly about that. The Bible is quite clear about that as far as Christians are concerned. Now, why is it of such importance in Israel that these rules obtain for its womanhood? Why? Because Israel would eventually produce a Mary, a virgin, a handmaid of the Lord. And the difference in the approach to sex and marriage between Israel and the other nations had its root in the purpose of God. And ultimately, there would come, in the fullness of time, one who was a virgin to be the mother of the Lord himself. And you will find in the Old Testament how time and again the devil seeks to prevent that. What was it, other than the devil's activity, which caused Moab to persuade the women of Midian to lie with the men of Israel? The occasion when the Levites stood for the Lord. Remember the occasion. What is it that here in this chapter tells us that the men who are here discussing things, well, they can take our daughters and our wives? The society, which was immoral, except that it might defile the passage through which ultimately would come the virgin who was to be the mother of Christ. Absolute humanity. And so the scriptures are quite clear about the approach which the Lord had towards this sort of thing. Of course, in the New Testament, as far as Christians are concerned, the same scriptures are given concerning us in our particular relations. Now, another reason for their anger was that folly had been committed against Israel. The sons of Jacob appreciated the honorable destiny which was laid before the descendants of Jacob when God himself bestowed the name Israel upon their father. And they seemed to know that their tribe was destined to become a great people. After all, weren't they to multiply? Weren't they to be fruitful? Weren't they to possess land? And so on. And in these things, of course, they're to be commended. Now the Canaanites would have found what Shechem had done to be quite small, natural, certainly not reprehensible. But Jacob's son had a more conception of ethical and moral requirements. What they do thereafter that, however, is quite disastrous. And so what happens is marriage negotiations begin. And we need to note the Canaanites' laxity of morals. Because when they come to discuss this with the brothers of Dinah, they don't admit any wrong. They don't say that Shechem has done any wrong. What's been done in any case can be adjusted by marriage. And Jacob's people, of course, can be honored in the proposal of a matrimonial alliance of the princely line. Dinah can be married into the princely family. And if there's any problem about that, then, well, we can make a financial adjustment to that. We can pay a dowry, and we can smooth up all misunderstanding. In fact, the young prince himself was prepared to pay whatever the dowry that was required to smooth out the pathway for him. And the problem, of course, was to have a worldly solution as far as they were concerned. And ultimately, they were to be mixed marriages. But Jacob had many sons. But the marrying to a pagan society was, as far as Jacob was concerned, outside the will of God. Amar offered security, of course, because what he said to them, well, you can dwell amongst us. So there was security in this. The agreement seemed to have its advantages. And alliance with his clan would increase these advantages. And what's more, he offered to Judah possessions of land, and there was commerce and trade, and well, it was a very good offer. It was a worldly offer. And Jacob, who had met God at Sheba, was not tempted. And again, this can be seen as one of the many satanic attempts to pollute the godly line. But what about Levi and Simeon? And we need to notice the duplicity that they showed. Notice what it says in verse 13. And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, deceitfully. And the word deceitfully we've already come across, of course. We've come across this in relation to Jacob's feeling of the blessing, and the word deceitfully was used in that context. And then, of course, it was used by Jacob later on when he upbraided Laban for his treatment of himself. Laban had acted deceitfully. He had switched the brides, and that had been a deceitful action. And that same word is used here now for the action of Levi and Simeon. And, well, we read the plan that they had in mind. You know, it's noticeable that when a person is out of touch with God, there are no depths to which that person might not sink. And I have a memory in my mind of a brother meeting which I am, who, as a young man, was much used of the Lord, and proved to be quite a promising preacher. Qualified as a doctor, went to Australia, Thailand, came back to the assembly that I'm in, and began to be led away from the Lord. Just away from the Lord. First indication that I got of it was that he couldn't see the purpose of prayer. Confessed that to me, he didn't see why he had to pray anymore, he couldn't see the purpose of prayer. Rang me up one day and said that a Jehovah's Witness had come to his door and he'd had a conversation with her. And apparently this young woman knew me because at some stage she had been taught by me in college. And he said, you know, I see very little difference between what she believes and we believe. And the alarm bells were ringing furiously. And he left his wife, went off with another woman, and is as far away from the Lord as he could possibly be. Man who had a testimony at one stage. And as frank as though you can be, virtually. and lost all his testimony and all profession of being a Christian. Now, there are those who have doubts as to whether he was a Christian at all in the first place. But there is also the other problem of how low a Christian can sink once he gets on a slippery slope away from God. And these men, two men who were of the people of God, sank to deception and to murder. And that's what we're going to look at the moment. And we'll see what they planned and how they planned it. Now, Shechem has offered any price, any dowry. It's not the case of how much you can pay, they said. It doesn't matter about the amount. You see, money doesn't come into this situation. It's all a matter of our belief, our faith. What beliefs we have. It's not a matter of finance. It's a religious matter. Dinah mustn't marry anyone who's uncircumcised. It's a matter of what we believe, of our faith. There's a solution to this problem, of course. And that solution is that you must all become circumcised. Like us. And then we can intermarry and we can become one people. And the scripture says, of course, that they spoke deceitfully. They had no intention of what they were saying. But how low can you think then, yet professing to be the people of God? And what they were preparing to do was to use the sign of the covenant, that is the rite of circumcision, to become the means of a purely human argument. They were to use a ceremony, which was a part of their faith, in order to ensnare these people in Shechem. Ceremonies, rituals, whatever. Without faith in the God of the covenant can be anything. Could not be anything but earthly and carnal. And they were using the sign of the covenant in a very carnal and earthly way. And worse still, they were using it to wreak vengeance upon those who had defiled their sister. And upon men who were completely unsuspecting. And it was a pretext to cover treachery. There was an appearance of piety, but underneath there was the intention to carry out murder. And they were clothing their wickedness in a religious garb. It's like that sort of dishonesty. And there's no dishonesty like it. Which wraps around itself biblical texts to hide its true intention. Tamar had to sell the property to the countrymen, so he goes down to the gate of the city and he's going to tell them what the plan is. And there's much in it, of course, for us in the line he took. What he said was the Israelites are to be assimilated. The Shechemites could enrich themselves with the wealth and possession that Jacob brought with him. That was the carrot. Verse 23, shall not their cattle and their substance, every beast of theirs be ours, only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us. So the carrot was that the Shechemites would enrich themselves by means of the cattle of Jacob and his family. And so they told the plan. And the rite of circumcision was administered on the second day thereafter while the men. And after that, while the men of the city were still incapacitated, Levi and Simeon carried out their plan in the mass slaughter of the men in verses 26 and 28 tell us about that slaughter. And then it's interesting to notice that though they had carried out the slaughter, in verse 27 it says, the sons of Jacob came upon the slain. And so it appears that it eventually, in the act itself, after Simeon and Levi had initiated it, all the sons of Jacob, all of them, without probably the inclusion of Joseph, would have been a young man at that particular time. Really, with the might to work out exactly whether he was 15 and a half or 16 and a half. But the fact is that it is probable that he was not amongst them, and that certainly his character would have been such, even at that stage, had not joined with them. But the sons of Jacob, it says, live all but part in front of the city. Strange, isn't it, that those who slew them were Levi and Simeon. So the others must have had some compunction about slaying the men, but they had no compunction about rifling the city and plundering it after that. So Levi and Simeon avenged the sin which was committed on Dinah by a far greater sin and a great and a more terrible incident. And of all that, first of all, we need to notice the fair words which are spoken by God's people to the people of Shechem. And yet those fair words were to bring disaster upon the unsaved men of Shechem. And all that was done upon the city of Shechem was done upon them by the people of God as the people of God. And how sad it is to notice that they did all this, although it was doing it in the process of avenging immorality. Now, it was commented on last night by Keith, and let me re-emphasize it. We have no right to act unrighteously in a righteous cause. Punishment of immorality might be right, but to act unrighteously to punish it is not right. God never does so, and is eternally opposed to such actions. We mustn't do evil that good might come. Neither must we employ evil methods for the punishment of evil. It does seem a good thing to visit wrongdoers with vengeance, and of course immorality must be punished. But it's wholly reprehensible to do so with an act which involves infidelity to the covenant made with God. And God never means that wrong should be done in order to the vindication of right. That is a process which he never approves of. And at last Jacob breaks down and he rebukes his two sons. And we'll look at that in verse 20. Verse 30, I'm sorry. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. But one thing you notice about this particular statement is how self-centered it is. There is no mention of God in it at all. There was no blame here for the sin which they had committed, only for the danger which had accrued because of it. He had been saved from Laban. He had been saved from Esau. But now there was a third calamity which was threatening him, and that was being overwhelmed by the prizes from the combined forces of the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And he had been conscious of God in the early occasions, and he makes mention of that. But here there's no mention of God now. How could God rescue him after the treacherous murder of innocent men? And Jacob rather was wholly concerned with the repercussions of their brutality upon himself and upon his house. His sons, he doesn't say, had caused God's name to be reprehensible amongst the heathen. His sons, their action had caused his name to stink. The dishonor abroad which would be brought upon the name of the Lord was lost sight of in the fact that it was his name which was caused to sleep. Well, let's not be too critical again of Jacob. Most of us have a long way to go, I would think, before we would be able to say with Paul without reservation, not I, but Christ. Jacob shows then a sad failure here, that even after his great encounter with God at Jabbok, he shows a sad failure not walking in the habitual exercise of the principle of faith and belief in his promises. Here his mind is too full of his danger amongst the Shechemites than with the security in the hand of God. What he should have done is judged himself. If he had not settled at Shechem, Dinah would have not been defiled. If he had not settled at Shechem or Shechem, his sons would not have been so active. If he had not settled at Shechem, his name would have stunk. And Christians often still get into deep sorrows and problems because of their own unfaithfulness to the pathway of faith. And instead of judging themselves, they begin to look at circumstances and to cast on them the blame. Well, it was because I was living in a, working in a very difficult place, of course, and all my neighbors were difficult, and so on. And Jacob lacked still that refined sensibility to see that his low position was the cause of it. And so God, in faithfulness, was going to use these circumstances through which he was passing to chasten him. Now, Simeon and Levi seem to have the last word here. You noted it in verse 31. Should he deal with our sister as a harlot? As you know, Jacob never forgave them. And the last word doesn't rest with them. It rests with him. And on his deathbed, in chapter 15-49, he says, cursed be their anger. They shall be divided in this field. And it was because they how an ox, it's a word in the letter. That means to say, the symbolic way of saying that they killed a son who was a prince. But the last word ends, of course, with Jacob in chapter 49. And so it is then that the Lord sends Jacob back to Bethel, to renew his vows, and to assure himself once again of all that God has promised him. And so he has to leave Shechem, separate himself from it, and to take his pathway down the country on the way to Bethel. And we'll meet him then at Bethel, after a break until 5 o'clock.